and welcome to a bonus episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan, and my pronouns are she, her. Joining me on the podcast this time is Scott Carson, who you may know as Michael Carita. Scott Carson is Michael's pen name, and you'll learn more about that in the interview. And his new book is called Lost Man's Lane, a supernatural thriller mystery set in 1999. It's a fantastic book, and we had a really amazing chat about it. The book is available from Gibson's Bookstore, and you should keep an eye on Gibson's social media because Michael Carita will be swinging by the bookstore for a drop-in, meet-and-greet signing in early April. For now, though, let's jump right into the interview. Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me here. It's a shame we're not in person. I'd much rather be at the store, but we'll take this.
Yeah. It was so fun to see you last time you swung by. And I think you're coming maybe this spring for another quick pop-in session.
So. Yeah, I'll be in New Hampshire in April, beginning of April.
Awesome. Deeply looking forward to that. But so for today's, we're here to talk about Lost Man's Lane, which is by you as Scott Carson.
As Scott Carson, the name you can pronounce effortlessly.
Is that when you picked a pen name, were you like, what's the easiest possible name?
It was kind of a consideration. My dream for the pen name was that no one would know. Like, I would really be able to pull it off for at least a few books, a few years. And that lasted about maybe 2 months before it became apparent that the publisher wants you to promote the book. Mm. And it becomes a little more challenging to do that if you don't exist. So I never did get to have the experience of handing, you know, family and friends a book and saying, what do you think of this guy? And then getting the genuine, honest, unfiltered response, mm-hmm. Which might be for the best in some relationships. But I wanted to sort of create, under the Carita name, I bounced around between supernatural stories, thrillers, crime novels. And so I wanted to create something that just stayed in the lane of, okay, if it's going to have ghosts, if it's going to have anything weird, anything that is in my wheelhouse of horror, this is the name. Mm-hmm. And after 15 years of, just as a writer, let alone 40 years of life, hearing people butcher my last name, having something really simple seemed very appealing.
That makes a lot of sense. It's funny. If I can find like a YouTube video of an author saying their own name, like I usually look those up ahead of time and then I always confirm with the author. And the amount of different pronunciations I saw of other people saying your name on YouTube, and I was like, oh this poor guy.
Yeah. There's a point around like book 9 or 10 where you just think, you know, Carson would be a good name. Or you look at someone like Stephen King. Now, there are many reasons to envy Stephen King, but no one in the history of his life has screwed up his name, ever.
That's true.
Joe Hill, very smart.
Very simple. Yeah. No, I get it. I sympathize. But yeah, it's funny because I was going to ask if in choosing the pen name, if you had wanted it to be secret or if you kind of always knew, but that's so funny that You didn't even get to try. I mean,
not really. Although the early trade reviews, it wasn't out yet, mm-hmm. and I think it was Publishers Weekly, or maybe Library Journal. One of them referenced, you know, how at the ends of those reviews it'll say "perfect for fans of whoever," yeah. And it was like "perfect for fans of Peter Straub and Michael Carita." And so I had that one moment of saying, okay, somebody dialed in and didn't know. And I loved that. But then the book came out and my publisher, you know, go figure, they wanted me to do interviews and try to sell them books.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to play along with that. But I did want a longer run than I had.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I got to imagine that it would be kind of fun to be anonymous for a little while, because I've had that thought of like I've talked to authors who are like, oh, if I could go back, I would just from the jump, I would use a pen name.
Oh,
Which,
absolutely. I would if I could go
yeah.
back.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think about like if I ever finish writing the book in my brain, I'm like, a pen name makes a lot of sense, but also like I've built up such a community around myself that I'm like, oh,
Right, you have a brand. That
how do I
dreaded word.
Yeah, but I do. It's true. And
You
so I'm like,
do.
oh, I don't know if I could. I think I would be kind of forced to. I guess I could change my last name because enough people just know me as Bookseller Ryan that I think maybe I could change my last name. But
You could be
everybody knows
like
I'm at Gibson's, like
Prince
everybody.
or Seal, just the one name.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Well, we are here to talk about Lost Man's Lane, which I'm a little over halfway through. I'm at like the Halloween point. I'm having a great time with it. It's so good.
Very good. Thank you.
But so it comes out later this month. So for the listeners who haven't obviously had a chance to read an advanced copy, tell us about Lost Man's Lane.
So it's set in Bloomington, Indiana in 1999, which is my hometown and kind of the era I grew up in. And I had just finished writing a crime novel that was really dark, and very serious. And I wanted to have fun. So this is kind of it's odd, I guess, says something about my warped mind that when I wanted to have fun, I turned to horror. But I wanted it to sort of have the feel of that classic coming of age kind of horror. Obviously, Stand By Me, The Body comes to mind. But also, John Irving, A Prayer for Owen Meany was sort of in the back of my mind of the kid who, the fatherless kid who's looking for his dad. And as he discovers, so he joins forces with this private investigator in his hometown, and he's trying to figure out the identity of his father because his mother has never given him any clue. And so it's, while sort of unwrapping the secrets of his hometown, he's also finding the secret of himself. And it's right in that wheelhouse of obviously King, but Bradbury. One of my all-time favorite books is Boy's Life by Robert McCammon. I loved that book. So it was a chance to kind of go back to those influences. And I don't think I've ever had more fun writing one.
Nice. It is a fun read. And you do the thing that I love so much in that, like, because you have your main narrator reflecting and remembering these events, like going back to his teenage years. And so there something will happen and the narrator will be like, yeah, I didn't know it then, but this was about to change my life. And I love that because I'm just like,
Oh,
ooh, I'm hooked. More, more, more.
I'm glad to hear you like that because it's one of those things where it's such a fine line to
Yeah.
balance those sort of intrusions of voice. And I always enjoy it as a reader, but it needs to be pretty light on the throttle, I think. The risk is always that you undercut the tension. Because you want to feel as if the, even in first person narration, when we assume the narrator usually makes it out, you always want to feel a heightened risk, right? You want to feel like your characters are in jeopardy. So I never wanted to undermine that, but I always love, just as you described it, it's the sort of back and forth across eras, that voice that can reflect and then take us back into scene. I think when that's done well, it adds sort of a nostalgia, which I really enjoy, but then it also can put it, it can layer in the promise of foreshadowing there are big losses ahead. And for the reader, then you don't know what the loss will be, when it will happen, or at what cost. And that's always been something I really enjoy as a reader. It just deepens that immersion. It makes it much harder to put the book down.
There's this is a page turner. I have had a lot of trouble putting it down because I just want to know what's gonna happen next. And speaking of nostalgia, so when your publicist emailed me about this, she was like, yeah. And it's like kind of historical fiction set in the 90s. And I was like, first of all, how dare you? But
Historical fiction and the 90s should not coincide yet.
how dare? But it is interesting because, yeah, it's set in 1999. And you do kind of take that, not kind of, you do write it in that like historical fiction style of explaining things, but not in a like, I assume you're dumb, but just in a anyone in the future can read this and will get enough context kind of way. And it's just been really fun to like relive like, Instant Messenger and my angsty away
Exactly.
messages.
Instant Messenger and how we all thought Napster was going to be a great thing for the artist. And then, I did want to layer in sort of the events of the day because I think 99 was a really interesting time capsule where we felt largely very safe. And both on the global scale, but particularly at home. And the book ends of kind of, I guess the big events of the day are Columbine and 9/11. And that was a very interesting transition point. And also, I became fascinated when I was looking back at the newspapers from 99 and 2000. I was fascinated by how poorly we predict things. Like the front page news, and this is so consistent, like from my own little local newspaper to the New York Times, the front page news often just kind of fizzled. It was not the big driving thing. But what really mattered was on page like A25. And I think that's very consistent across generations. We're not good at predicting the big thing in that moment. And 99 in Bloomington was a year when we had, and this is also in the book. So you would have read this stretch. There were these killings, a guy named Ben Smith, who was a disciple of a white supremacist named Matt Hale. He went on this multi-state murder spree, and that came through Bloomington, came through my hometown. And a couple of years later, I ended up interviewing Matt Hale at this. I was working for the newspaper at that point. And he was up in northern Indiana at this kind of rally with a bunch of skinhead neo-Nazi types. And he was trying to convince me that they were not a fringe movement because I didn't understand the reach of the internet. And he talked about the idea of the public square having like disappeared. And people didn't see, Klan rallies in the public square anymore, so they thought it was gone. And he was saying, but you don't understand. At that point, I think it was all like forum based. Like, you don't know how many members I have on my forums. And I'm listening to this repellent content coming out of his mouth, but I'm also thinking he's wrong. I firmly believed that he had to represent a very, very fringe movement. And then you look back with 25 years of distance and think, oh no, I was wrong. There was a lot more out there that he was tapped into. And he also was tapped into the power of anonymous hate and sort of the keyboard warriors, like before that was remotely a thing. And it's been really, it was, disturbing then, but I think it's more disturbing to me while I was writing it to go back and have to really reflect on it and think, no, he was right. And at the time, I thought he was the, I mean, he's still, I want to believe, an outlier, but he wasn't as crazy as I wanted him to be in terms of his reach and the way people would embrace the anonymous.
And it's scary how quickly that right, like the internet was a baby and already it had these
Already,
groups of
absolutely. That's a great point. It's like as soon as we created the community, it then was flooded with all of the, there are positive things there, but pretty quickly we had some really, really dark forces. And that's what I enjoy as a writer playing with those elements of reality, and then layering in the supernatural too. So
Mm-hmm.
if it works, I think it ideally works on two levels, where one is a mirror of the other. You know, we have our supernatural threat, which is I'm playing heavily with, you know, like snake mythology in this book. But that idea of sort of the snake in the grass that you don't see, and but that doesn't mean they're not there. And you
Yeah.
know, who is going to be affected? All of that was a lot of fun. And also, Y2K was something that I
Yeah.
really was intrigued by that, because I remember it. I think most of our generation, when we hear it, we sort of smile like it was this joke. It
Right.
never happened. Come on. But
Yeah.
if billions of dollars hadn't been spent, it could have been a much more serious thing. And then it also served as this sort of recruiting tool of paranoia that I think was ahead of its time. You know, the idea of fear, and you've got to protect your own, and there's an isolationist quality to the threat will come from the outside, and I need to worry about protecting my own little den here. And that has rippled out in different ways and still is, I think. But I when you read about Y2K, you see, I think, more, it had more of a legitimate impact than I would have guessed. It just feels to me like it was a thing we shrugged off and it became kind of cute.
That's so interesting because like I remember having all the canned goods stocked up and in our basement and the extra bottles of water and all of
Right.
that and
Make
then
sure
it,
that the
but
power was full of gas and it's going to take about a week, right?
just kind of like and my family wasn't like super they didn't really talk about it but like I knew that we had like stores of food and water and things like that. Like I knew that it was there was a threat, but I think my grandparents like weren't super, I don't think they super believed it, but they
Yeah.
were like, just in case we're wrong, we'll have these backups. But
Right.
like I remember
Yeah.
having friends whose parents were like, no, this is going to like end the world. And I was like, oh, okay.
So that was the character of Jerry. So Jerry Flanders is the book's told, it's first person narration, and the kid who leads it is named Marshall Miller. But his best friend in the world is this girl he grew up across the street from named Carrie. And it's her father is the character I built into the sort of Y2K prepper. And I don't remember anyone who was all in the way I make Jerry, you know, all in. But I definitely share your memories of, you know, going over to a friend's house and realizing, like, whoa, you know, her dad is taking this much more seriously. And I don't remember leaving any of those encounters thinking, should my family be? I think, you know, I just moved in and out of it. My dad was an electrical engineer working at a university. So he had been working on the sort of the prep and the buildup, the utility buildup on it for probably 2 or 3 years. And we would always go. My family's originally from Cleveland, so we would go back to Cleveland around the holidays to see grandparents, you know, things of that nature. And that year, if we went, I don't think we went, but if we did go, I know we had to be back by New Year's Eve because the university was ready, you know, for the grid to go down, whatever. And then nothing happened, and that was, we all kind of moved on. But when you think about, I was interested in the psychological price of believing, and it's so easy to, I didn't want to be overtly political with like 1999 is like, you know, 2024, because I believe the readers are actually smart enough to do that thinking for themselves. But it did make me kind of curious about the price of going all in, believing something is going to happen, and then it doesn't. You know, what does that cost you, and what does that cost your family?
No, it's definitely an interesting lens to be viewing. And it's So, like the Columbine thing, like I was young enough that I wasn't told about the events of Columbine until a few years later, because I was in third grade and they did not tell us about that. I think I maybe knew something bad happened, but I didn't find out the details until I remember being in sixth grade and they had like the parents of one of the victims came and did a presentation at my middle school. And that was the first time I was like, oh, whoa, wait, what happened? Whereas like Y2K and 9/11, like those were the big
Signature,
things for me.
yes,
Yeah.
yeah.
And so like it was interesting reading, the Marshall and Carrie kind of walking into the library and seeing the librarian like sobbing because of what was unfolding on the news. And I was like, oh, I didn't have that for Columbine. I did have that for 9/11. I did. It was that kind of like, oh, we're getting let out of class early. Ha ha, jokey, jokey. And then walking into our homeroom and being like, why does my teacher look so upset? Like, why are the grown-ups scared? This is weird. And that very jarring
That
thing.
is exactly the emotion I wanted to capture. There is nothing that rattles you as a kid more than when you see that the grown-ups and or the institutions are helpless. There's something very jarring about that. And for me, I was in high school during Columbine, and actually that scene in the book you just described is probably one of the few scenes that's like spot on to my own experience of it. And then I remember, so that the sort of Jerry character, I remember everyone from parents to politicians saying and believing, and we believed them, it was like never going to happen again after Columbine. You will not see this again. And I think most of us actually believed that. It was like, of course, after a tragedy of that scale, you won't see it again because the people in charge will fix it. And then you get to like this generation, talk to high school students in this generation, and they would laugh in my face if I said that. Like, they know better. You're not going to fool them. We're not going to fix that. Or we at least we haven't.
And it's so especially frustrating because, right, like 2 years later with 9/11, it was like the next day the entire airline security, everything changed.
Right.
And you would
Yes.
never go through the airport the same way again.
Same way again. But you'd
But
walk into a school with the, actually, with less protection, with less regulation now than you would have.
And like I remember my high school, we, as far as I know, we never had any like gun threats, but we had a lot of bomb threats, which we all just thought were jokes because it was just people writing it on bathroom stalls or whatever. But
It's a good day off.
it literally like there was one called into my cousin's prom, so they had to cancel prom and it like crazy things. But I do remember when they beefed up all of the security at the high school, and all of a sudden there were like metal detectors, and there were cops on every corner, and you couldn't wear hats anymore, and there were cameras all the way through. And but so there were like all of these security measures, but then you could still just walk in the side door. And there was never anyone there. So it was just, I remember being in high school being like, well, this did nothing. Like,
It was
this is
more
all
the
just for
theater of,
show. Yeah.
yes.
This is, you're just trying to make the parents feel better. But like, I can walk in the side building, it's always unlocked and no one's ever standing there. And the camera points the other direction. Like, what are you doing? So this is kind of jumping off of this whole thing. And thinking about the kinds of research that you did for this. So obviously you looked through kind of the old newspapers and things and you got that kind of 90s perspective, but what kind of research did you do for like the snake mythology and also for like the private detective, like the private investigator stuff? Where does that knowledge come from?
Yeah, the PI stuff is actually taken straight from my personal life. So when I was 15, 16 years old, because I didn't even have my driver's license yet when I first reached out to this guy. My high school had a program called Independent Study, And it was basically like, you could go help out at the Y or whatever it was. Just like you could get out of class for a while. And most people, I think, treated it as sort of a glorified internship. And I knew that I wanted to write, and I knew I wanted to write PI novels at the time. I was really intrigued by that. So I pitched to the woman who ran the program at my school. I said, what about an independent study in, private detective work? And she said, if you can find a qualified mentor, I will allow that. And there were three. My town wasn't particularly big. It's like 100,000 people. There were three in the phone book. This is back in the Yellow Pages era. I called them in alphabetical order, and one just like hung up on me. One blew me off politely. And then the third one, it was Trace Investigations, and his name, great PI name, Don Johnson. He actually agreed to meet with me, and it ended up being, it was a life-changing opportunity. And we're still in touch. We're still friends to this day. My wife ended up buying out sort of a half of his business, the background check side. So that's her full-time job. And I started with him in high school as an intern. Much, which is Marshall in the book. And then it was my part-time job during college, and it was my day job when I graduated from college until I was able to make enough money to support myself writing. So, and I guess, I mean, I still kind of have my hand in it a little bit, although I don't even know if I have keys to my wife's office. I don't think she ever gave me one. So she's pretty well boxed me out of it, but I've always stayed around the PI business, and the scenes of Marshall learning that kind of work at the end of an era, it was identical to my experience where we had the internet, and I was probably more internet savvy than Don was at that point. But so much work was still done. Like you would have to go to the courthouse, you would have to go through these dusty old files. And you had to learn how to, which is it, the auditor or the recorder or the treasurer, and what records do they have? And all of the clerks were, some were friendly, some really did not love a 16-year-old kid showing up saying, hey, I need tax records on this property. But navigating that in retrospect, it was always fun. I mean, I loved it because when you're 16, 17 years old and all of your friends have jobs at like an ice cream shop or whatever, and you're working on some level with a PI, it seems so much cooler and just better stories to tell, right? But also I loved, there was something about, and I hope this comes through in the book, there was something about that moment when you meet someone who's not a parent or a grandparent, who has no interest in you, or a teacher who treats you like an adult and not a kid. And that person who, whenever you find them, they are so crucial. And so I'm trying to get some element of that mentorship quality into the book, and just like what it means to Marshall in particular, because he doesn't have a father. And I had a father, so I didn't go through that. But otherwise, the education of it and being in that circle of, I want to learn about the job so I can write about the job. That was all, straight from reality.
So cool. That's
It was the
so cool.
best high school gig in the world. I look back on it now,
Seriously.
and I still can't really believe that I pulled it off. And I know my high school was surprised when I walked back into the counselor's office and said, I have the qualified mentor, and I know that they didn't think I was going to deliver this guy, so.
Oh, that's amazing. No, I love that. And yeah, I love the character of Noah Storm, which is such a good PI name.
It's no Don Johnson, but
It's not
it's
Don Johnson, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good. No, I totally that totally comes across that, like, oh, I'm impressing this adult, and he seems genuinely impressed with my knowledge and my observations, and like he has no reason to make this up, so it must be true. Like, It's very
And then
cool.
also how much easier it is for that adult to motivate you,
Yeah.
as opposed to, your grandmother saying, "I want you to do better at this." It's
Yeah.
like, well, okay. But when
Sure.
someone who has no skin in the game where you're concerned offers critique, I think it lands in a very different way. And I
Yeah.
have some of some of Noah's little mantras are basically stolen or massaged versions of lines that I bet Don doesn't even remember telling me some of these things. They stuck out to me so much. Like if I would screw up, not even screw up, but miss something. Like I remember him saying after I had missed something that I should have seen in a file, it was this like just very mild disappointment. And he said, "It's a detail-oriented business, Michael." And I was like, ooh, that one stung in a way that my father, like ranting and raving, would not have made the same impact as that
Nope.
one little line there, because it's a different relationship. And you
Yeah.
want so desperately, when you're 16, 17 years old, you want so desperately to be treated as an adult because you feel like you are. You
Yeah.
feel like the world does not appreciate how mature you are.
Yeah.
Even though you're not, it's still like this sense of, you think you're an adult, so you want people to treat you as such. And then your daily routine is kind of this exercise in humility where they ring a bell and you have to go off to the next class. You have to, report back to your family.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. And the one of his little mantras or whatever that really stuck with me was the no one can focus for you. It's like,
Yes.
oh, that's good.
Yep, that's
That's a
Don
good one.
Johnson at his finest.
Don Johnson, what a guy.
I also, I think I probably didn't get the quote verbatim, but another one he had was, so he had been a carpenter in a previous life. He went from Air Force intelligence to doing some like set building for I think summer theaters after he got out of the military, and then went to work in New York for the Burns Detective Agency, which was like the big national PI agency. But he had this carpenter background, and he had a line about like every construction site has two guys. There's the guy who measures twice, and then there's the guy with nine fingers. And I thought that was such a great line in terms of, again, like focus and concentration, but
Yeah.
it's much more vivid because you have the guy who's cut off his own finger. So
Yeah, you got Stumpy and
yeah, Stumpy, exactly. That's I think in the book it's Stumpy.
and which one do you want to be? No, for sure. Yeah, no, I love that, and I love that Marshall does like he does want to impress Noah, and even when things are getting chaotic and he's not maybe trusting his own mind and things like that, he's like, I kind of want to go talk to Noah about this. And it's just like, oh, I love that. So this made me laugh. So Marshall gets pulled over the same day he gets his license. Do you remember the first time you were?
Oh, I absolutely remember the first time I pulled over. It was much closer to getting my driver's license than it should have been. I made it a few days. It wasn't the day of, but it didn't take long. It also didn't take me long to wreck my first car. And I need to clarify that. It didn't take me long to wreck my mother's car, which really didn't help anything. There's also a written exam portion of that intro that is sadly verbatim from my own experience, where I got distracted or overly confident and got offline, and the clerk was reading back to me the answers that I got wrong. And the honk and proceed with caution response to the police officer is what I actually filled out. So I've been living with that one for years, as my older sister in particular loved to mock me for that one. But it was all worth it because when Stephen King read the galley of the book this summer, he sent me an email and the subject was honk and proceed with caution. And I thought, okay, well, take that, family members who have been mocking me for 25 years. Stephen King now is responding to it favorably.
I love that. I love that. 'Cause yeah, and I think we all have like our stupid moments that we did because, we're dumb teenagers behind a very dangerous thing. Yeah, mine was I don't remember if it was the first time I got pulled over, but it was the most memorable time was I realized that I was trying to drive back to school and I got on like the wrong highway. Like I got on going south and I needed to be going north. And now an adult, I'm like, oh, you just pull off of the next exit and get back on the highway going the correct way. But I, a dumb teenager, had a panic attack and pulled into that like middle part
Oh,
that the
yes.
cops
The
hide out in,
median, yes. Very nice.
which is not where you're supposed to go. And I did not realize that there was a cop behind me. He pulled up behind me and he was like, hey, dumb dumb, what are you doing? And I was like, panicking is what I'm doing.
I had a friend who I sort of borrowed one of his adventures when he was pulled over and did the thing where he went across. It was a two-lane road with, the marked center line. And he drove across the oncoming lane to pull off on the other side. And then the cop's like, what are you doing? And he said, it looked like there was more room over here. And so I kind of stole that from Marshall's moment where it's as if I'm trying to make it more convenient and safer for you too, officer. Like, there's a
Yeah,
lot
I'm trying
of
to help
room
you
over here
out.
across the oncoming lane of traffic. So we've
Yeah.
all had those great moments.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I got a good chuckle out of poor Marshall's first day with a license. Just everything.
My thought was that more people would be able to relate to that in some way than not.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think we've all got our crazy stories from that. And then, of course, I was just so impressed with his observation skills because I would be a terrible witness. I couldn't tell you what people were wearing, what color hair they have, what kind of car they were, like none of it. It all just disappears. And so I was so impressed that he, A, noticed the girl in the back of the cop car, B, noticed what she was wearing, and C, remembered it. Because if I had been Marshall about 20 minutes later, I would have been like, I don't know, I think she was wearing a cheerleading outfit or something. I don't know. Like, just
You're a much more
instant car.
realistic eyewitness because
Yes,
eyewitnesses are inherently terrible.
yeah.
Although there's an element, so later in the book, he goes into Noah's like creepy basement to sketch it. And it's sort of a hypnosis exercise. And that's a real thing. So I was a criminal justice major, and I remember encountering this case study. I want to say it was LAPD, maybe like 70s or 80s. But they were working with hypnosis a lot more then. And
Interesting.
then they ran into some issues, particularly in the courtroom, of is hypnosis guiding witness? And so there's debate about that. But they had one kidnapping case where under hypnosis, they got a witness who could barely remember the car, the type of car, the color. They got the witness to accurately recall enough of the license plate that they ID'd the vehicle. And I thought that
Wow.
was just fascinating because it's a window into how much more we see and perceive and then file away unconsciously. And our conscious mind says, no, like there's a gap here. And then what the eyewitness always does is try to help too much. So they try to fill in the gap. And that's how you get to these disaster scenarios that are so frequent, where someone's ID'd and it wasn't them at all. It's not due to a malicious eyewitness usually. It's due to this very natural human instinct of, I want to be helpful, and your brain wants to help. So your brain says, oh, let me just fill in the gap of memory there. But your unconscious mind actually traps it a little bit better. And I think that's As a writer, that's absolutely true. It's like, get out of the
Yeah.
way, don't steer for the characters, don't put words in their mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is that moment where I think it's Noah talking to Marshall for the first time, and he's like, tell me everything, but don't fill in any blanks that you have. Like, just tell me what you remember. And I was like, that sounds like a real
Yeah,
tactic. Like
that would be a real
that sounds
technique.
legit. Yeah.
And the sketching element is actually like that's also a real technique.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd be a terrible witness. I would like to think that I would be helpful, but ultimately I would probably just create more work for people because, yeah, I'd be like,
Okay, so my lesson here is if I'm going to commit a crime, do it in
do
your
it in front of
presence.
me.
Yes, exactly. So.
And you will absolutely get away with it because I will
You'll see
not even
nothing.
notice.
Remember.
I won't notice a single thing. I will, in fact, be avoiding eye contact, so I won't even see it happen.
Perfect. Next
Oh.
time I'm in the store, you stay behind the register, and then when the place is cleaned out at the end of the day,
It's so weird.
don't
I
point
didn't see
out.
anything. I don't know. I was here all day. I don't know. I didn't see anything weird. Don't tell my boss. So, heading towards sort of the wrap up of the interview, although I could definitely ask you more questions. I could talk to you all day about this. But we'll sort of head towards the wrap up and ask, what do you like to read?
Oh boy. Okay. We're going to need 20 to 30 more minutes. I read really widely. So I read about 100 books a year, and I'd say it's probably like 60, 40 fiction to nonfiction.
Okay.
I think a lot of, the where do you get your ideas question, a lot of that actually comes from nonfiction. I'll find some kind of weird thing that I find really intriguing. And then, if no one's written about it before, then I'll be drawn toward that. On the fiction front, I mean, I'm a huge horror fan. So, obviously, King, Joe Hill, Paul Tremblay, I think, is fantastic. I'm sort of a latecomer to Grady Hendrix. I've really been enjoying him lately. Sarah Langan, Megan Abbott, I think, is really good. I'm leaving out so many people. And then on the crime fiction front, when I think of kind of early influences, Dennis Lehane is up there, top of the list. Michael Connelly, James Lee Burke, sort of writers of that world. I'm thinking more recently what I've read, because I've read some good galleys. Oh, Gabino Iglesias has a book coming
Oh,
out that I really like.
yes. Oh, I love him.
So that one's coming out soon. I know Paul has another one coming out.
Yes.
Lori Roy has one coming out. I really like her stuff. And that's a kind of cool crime novel set in Florida in the, I think it'd be 60s, no, 50s, but it incorporates this whole like the true history of Marilyn Monroe, which I did not know anything
Ooh.
about,
Yeah.
which was a very interesting concept. And let's see. Joe owes us a book. He's
Yes.
dragging, but I'm
He's
excited for it.
I was actually talking to his publicist the other day, and she swears that he swears there's one coming next year, but she also says she hasn't seen evidence of it yet, so we'll see.
I'm doing an event with him in April, which he was extremely generous to do. So I'll try to publicly, get him to confess to this delivery date.
Excellent.
I'm leaving out so many more people than, but yeah, within those two genres, I mean, I read really, really widely, and those would be my favorite fiction genres. Nick Cutter is someone I just, again, I kind of came late to that, but I read, what's the one where they're out on the island, The Troop?
Yeah, the truth. Yeah.
I really like that.
Yeah.
All right, what
Oh.
about you? Because I feel like you're even
Yeah.
more well-read.
Deep
What should
in
I
the
be reading?
horror. Rachel Harrison, love her. Josh Malerman, he's a big
Yes.
one. Have you read The September House by Carissa Orlando?
No.
That, if you like Grady Hendrix, you will love that book. It
Okay.
is her debut and it blew me away. It's a haunted house novel, but it's like so much more than that. But it's like the opening line is the woman being like, "The walls are bleeding again." Like it's just, it's
A great,
great.
great throwaway. Excellent. Did you read
Gosh.
Liz Hand's sort of return to Hill House territory?
I haven't read it yet. I haven't read it yet.
It's good. It's very good.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about that one. Gosh, yeah, I know. I'm also probably leaving out all of my friends.
Like
Tremblay, of
Sarah
course.
Pinborough has another
Oh
one coming
yeah.
out. I think
Yep, I
she's
like
really
Sarah
good.
Pinborough. Who do we have? Oh, Eric LaRocca, I love. Oh, John Durgan has a book coming out in May called Kosa, and it's like Rapunzel meets Drag Me to Hell, and it's so good.
Oh,
It's
nice.
so
Okay, with that
creepy.
mashup,
Oh.
you've got my attention.
Yeah, it's super, super good. We're doing an event with him, and I think Paul Tremblay is also on board for that event in June. So
Oh, nice. I might have to drive over to catch that
you
one.
should come to that one. It's gonna be quite
I
a
enjoy
time.
heckling Paul too. That's
Oh,
always
it's
a
so much
set.
fun. He's so much fun to heckle. His new book, though, genuinely scared me, which I didn't know was still possible.
He's terrific.
He's great.
And he has the unfortunate burden of just being like the world's nicest guy too, so.
No, he really is. But I have found though, and I think we talked about this last time you were here, that the horror genre is just filled with the nicest people.
Absolutely, yes.
They're all
And
just
the funniest
lovely.
and the nicest.
Yeah.
There's I know it sounds cliche, the whole like, oh, they work their demons out on the page, but there must be something to it because within that space, I find the nicest people. I'm leaving out like when I think about nice people and just like generosity, Chris Golden comes to mind and
Oh,
Brian
the
Keene. And
best.
there are people within that genre who go out of their way to help new writers and diverse writers and
Yeah.
with authenticity that I often find lacking in other areas of life, certainly, but also, but even book world, I feel like there's more of just more of a collective sense of support, you know, the
Yeah.
rising tide within this genre that I really like. And you know, everybody has their ego, I guess, but I do think most people in the horror genre get the idea of, hey, if we can direct people to good books in this space, it helps everybody. And
Absolutely.
we all want to read more good books. So.
I also think about like Clay MacLeod Chapman,
Oh,
incredibly
yeah.
nice. Like again, always like lifting people up. And you're right. It's like they're like I feel like all of the authors in the horror genre are friends, and so like they're all just supporting each other because they genuinely like one another, which is so cool. But yeah, I mean, I'm hilariously quite new to horror in the grand scheme of things. I only started reading horror a few years ago, really. But I felt like I was welcomed into the genre with open arms by all of these authors who were like, "Oh, you're passionate about our genre? Welcome. You're now one of us." And like,
Right.
I just haven't found that with any other genre where like the horror community is just so overwhelmingly supportive and just lovely, and they're just delightful people.
It
I
does,
love
it
it.
feels a little more authentic over here, I think,
Yeah.
for whatever
Yeah.
reason.
I'm a big fan of it.
I didn't realize you'd only been reading horror for a few years. I felt like you would have come from, you know, like reading John Bel-Air's at age 7 and never looked back.
I've always been spooky. Like I've always had the spooky, like Halloween's my favorite holiday since I was, born. And
As
I've
it
always
should
liked
be.
horror movies, right? Like I think it was like there's always been like an underlying I enjoyed horror. I mean, like one of the first book I ever bought at an indie bookstore was Coraline. So like I've always had like an aspect of that, but I didn't like lean into it until so like a coworker many years ago handed me an arc of Bird Box, and that was the first time that I went, oh, wait, I could be reading scary things all the time. But
This.
even then, it was a couple years until I really like jumped all the way in. I went down like the psychological thriller route with like the Gone Girls and all of that. Like I followed that route. And then I just kind of leaned in 2020. That was really where I was just like, no, I'm gonna just focus on horror, because that's all I
Was
want
a
to read
good
right
year to
now.
just say, let's embrace it.
Yeah,
If
I
I've
was
got
like,
to, if I'm living it every day, then.
I'm living a horror novel every day, so I might as well read something scarier than what's happening outside my window. So that was really when I leaned in. And then it was like 2022, like January 2022 is when I made my little like horror display, which eventually turned into the Gibson's horror section that we now have.
I
So it's
love
like,
this. You have such a
yeah,
good
I'm
volunteering
so
session
proud of
department,
it.
as you should be.
Yeah, so it's like kind of a new thing, right? So it's like I obviously had such imposter syndrome coming into this community being like, "Hi, I love what you guys do, but I'm new here." And they were like, "Great, we're happy to have you." Okay.
Also, you live in New England where
That
spooky stuff is mandatory, right? I mean,
is true. Yeah. We all have to
sun
have like
goes
a
down
base
early,
level.
long winters. We've got to embrace the spookiness.
Every building you go into is haunted at least a little bit. Like
Oh, for sure. Yes. You can't. There is no back road that doesn't have one little graveyard just off by itself.
Yeah. Truly, usually unmarked. You're just like, there's just bodies there. That's just bodies in the woods. Can we? Like, you built a fence around it, but that doesn't mean
That doesn't really mean still no names,
anything.
but we still have the markers. That's a book I love, a throwback. I know we need to wrap up, but did you ever read Joan Sampson's The Auctioneer, which I think is
No,
set in New
no.
Hampshire? That's a
Oh.
good, they did a paperback re-release within the last couple of years. And
Okay.
it was a big deal when it came out. It came out, I think, in the late 70s, and it was like a huge book. And then she died very young from cancer, maybe like 20s, early 30s.
Oh, wow.
But that book is, if you have not read it, I think you'll love it.
Excellent. I will add that to my list.
A good New
Fantastic.
Hampshire throwback.
I love that. I love New England horror. I love all of it. Awesome. Well, Michael slash Scott, your book comes out March 26th. Exciting. And we'll be seeing you in the bookstore in some
Right.
point in April. And in the meantime, I will be chucking Lost Man's Lane at everyone. Be like, hey, you should read this.
Please
This is
do.
real good.
Just it's heavy enough to bruise but not kill, so you
Exactly.
can go
It's
ahead and
just
really
enough to
wing it.
catch attention.
That's right. Exactly. Well, thank you very much. This was my pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks for chatting. It was good to see you.
Good to see you. Take care. See you soon.
Bye. Thanks again to Scott Carson slash Michael Carita for joining me on the podcast. What a great chat. He's so nice. A reminder to make sure that you're following Gibson's and The Laydown on social media so you can find out about upcoming events like Michael's upcoming drop-in signing. I'll put the links in the show notes. Lost Man's Lane is available from Gibson's Bookstore. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload new episodes and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the bookstore. Bye!